Welcome to the Nature of Mind podcast. Our mind is our most valuable asset and most dangerous possession. It can be amazingly creative or terrifyingly destructive. The Nature of Mind project invites you to learn from thinkers in psychology, neuroscience, philosophy, and Buddhism. Learn more at natureofmind.net. We hope you enjoy this episode.
I'm very delighted to introduce Carol. Actually, I need to ask you, is it Bowman or is it Bowman?
Bowman.
Bowman. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm very delighted to introduce Carol Bowman. And she's the leading expert in children's memories of past lives. And actually, from what I've been reading, I think you were one of the first, Carol, to do that kind of research in a very systematic way, although there have been a few cases. Of really collating all those experiences of children's memories of past lives. And also, Carol is a trained counsellor, and she's also been looking at the healing potential of memories of children's past lives and what it can teach us about our relationships within families and individuals' lives and how to help them. She's done a lot of research over the years, and she's written two books. One of them is called Children's Past Lives, and the other is Return from Heaven. So I wanted to start off, Carol, by just asking you how you got interested in children's past lives.
Yeah, I'd like to preface it saying that there was, I'm not the first in the field. Ian Stevenson really created the field of research back in the early 60s. I came onto the scene later in the 80s. I had no idea that children could have past life memories at the time. And this literally fell into my lap through my young son. That's how I got into this. In 1988, when he was five, he developed a phobia of loud booming sounds, which was really puzzling. It came out of nowhere, and we were at a fireworks display on the 4th of July, our Independence Day in the United States. Mm-hmm. And during the fireworks, he became absolutely hysterical. Mm-hmm. And he was a very brave little boy, very daring, so that his behavior really surprised me. And I didn't understand why he was so triggered by that sound. And I wrote it off as any mother would. You know, he was probably just too excited that day or had too much sugar, something set him off. But then it happened again a few weeks later when we were in an indoor swimming pool and people on the diving board would make this big booming, reverberating sound off the walls of the swimming pool building. And again, he became absolutely hysterical. So at that point, I figured out, okay, it's these noises that are triggering this hysteria in him. And I couldn't think of any source, you know, any exposure he could have had earlier in his life. I was a stay-at-home mother at that time, and he had an older sister, so I thought this behavior was really strange. And as fate would have it, a hypnotherapist was visiting me in my home in North Carolina at the time, because I had done a past life regression a year before for my chronic lung problems. And I have to add that that 1 2-hour session completely reversed my illness. So I had plunged deeply into my curiosity about what this phenomenon was and how a past life regression could heal a physical ailment. And because my friends were all amazed at my recovery, I invited the hypnotherapist who originally worked with me, Norman Ing, to our house to work with about a dozen of my friends. And during his stay at my house, I mentioned Chase's, my son's name is Chase, his phobia. And Norman suggested that we do an experiment, and I had no idea what he had in mind, but I trusted him, and I figured he would give Chase some post-hypnotic suggestion. So once he started school, which was he was about to do, he wouldn't freak out in school and go through this hysterical reaction. So anyway, Norman simply said to him, "Sit in your mom's lap." He was a little guy at the time. He was only five. "Close your eyes and just tell me what you see when you hear those loud sounds that frighten you." And immediately I could see his eyelids fluttering. And he started talking about, I'm hiding, about life as a soldier. He said, I'm hiding behind a rock. There's smoke everywhere. He said, I have a long gun with a sword at the end. And I had no idea what was going on. And I thought it was odd because Chase didn't even own a toy gun. He was not interested in war games or war toys like a lot of children are, or a lot of boys especially. And he went on to say that he was an adult. He was a man. He was a soldier. He didn't even know who he was shooting at. He didn't want to be there. He missed his wife and family. And that was the moment. And I still get goosebumps when I talk about that, because that was the moment when I realized, okay, we're in new territory. I don't know what's going on. But Norman, since he was a very experienced past life therapist at that point, he figured out that Chase was accessing a past life memory. So he just asked him open-ended questions. For example, like, what happened? You know, what happened next? And Chase, the flow, Norman kept the flow of the memory going by asking open-ended questions. And Chase went on to say that he was in this battle. He didn't want to be there. He missed his wife and family. And all of a sudden he clutched his right wrist and he said, I'm shot. And I black out. And Norman proceeded to say, well, then what happens? And he said, well, I wake up and I'm in a hospital, but it's not a regular hospital. I'm on a bench. It's not a bed, it's a bench. And they're bandaging my wrist and they tell me I have to go back into battle. I don't want to go. Mm-hmm. And he proceeded to say that he was walking back to battle. He was supposed to be behind a cannon. And he was not happy being there. He felt guilty about being a soldier. He didn't want to kill other people. And Norman picked up on Chase's seeming guilt and said in very simple language to a five-year-old, we live many different lifetimes on Earth, and sometimes we have to be soldiers. And as soldiers, sometimes we have to kill others or we are killed. There's no blame in that. And as strange as this sounded, I didn't think Chase would understand this, but I could feel his body relaxing on my lap.
It was, because he was only four, you say, so?
Five. Yeah.
Nine.
Mm. Yeah. And then he said, and then I go behind the cannon, and all of a sudden he opened his eyes and hopped off my lap, grabbed a cookie, and went to play with his Legos. You know, typical five-year-old behavior. And I was sitting there with my mind absolutely blown. And my daughter, who was nine at the time, his older sister, Sarah, said, Mom, the place where Chase said he was shot on his wrist, that's where he has his eczema. Mm-hmm. And I think in the shocking moment, I didn't even put that together. But since Chase had been a baby, he had a chronic and severe eczema on that spot on his wrist, which had not responded to any medical treatment. And we tried food elimination diets, homeopathy, salves, antibiotic, you know, everything. And it had not responded to any treatment. So the upshot of that was that within a few days, that eczema cleared up completely. Mm. And he asked for his first drum set. So he was the things that frightened him the most, the loud booming sounds, you know, he wanted to make those sounds. Yeah. And, you know, he's still a drummer. He's going to be 40 this year. Mm-hmm. But that experience just changed my perceptions completely. It was a game changer for me, that moment.
Because it's interesting, because you said, you know, that the therapist had been doing past life regression therapy was at your house, because you'd also had an experience, hadn't you, that led you to do the same sort of journey. I don't know if you wanted to say anything about that.
Well, I think everything's orchestrated.
Mm.
You know, I mean, really, you know, with our life paths. Mm. And my healing was so profound. Mm. But, you know, I decided after that I wanted to study past life therapy because it was so effective. And even my medical doctor was amazed that my lungs cleared up. I was very, very sick for a number of years. You know, it would come and go, but I was basically plagued by these chronic lung problems. Mm-hmm. So a year had elapsed before Norman came back to work mm-hmm. with Chase. And it was during that interim period that his phobia emerged. Mm. So I think that was all part of my plan. Mm. You know, so because I had had the experience, I recognized the significance of his experience. Up until that point, I had no idea children could have memories. Right. I had no idea children could have spontaneous memories without any prompting. You know, Chase was prompted to talk about his fear, but he wasn't in a state of hypnosis. It was just close your eyes and tell us what you see. It was kind of what they call a bridging technique in past life therapy. So I was in a position to understand the significance and the potential. And of course, I was obsessed, you know, trying to figure out what had happened. Do other children have these memories? And I hadn't heard of Dr. Ian Stevenson at that point. This was in 1988. And I started talking to parents in my community. They're pretty open-minded, only the open-minded parents. And, you know, I was getting reports. Yeah, my daughter said something, my three-year-old, my four-year-old. And they were open to the idea, but no one was talking about healing. And I was just started collecting cases. And then I had enough cases to write an article and got it published in the Edgar Cayce magazine, if you're familiar with Edgar Cayce's work, which is, you know, receptive audience. They believe in reincarnation. And I started getting letters from parents all over the United States. I put a reader ad in a couple of magazines asking for cases. This is pre-internet days, and I started collecting them. I was seeing patterns in these memories. A lot of children under the age of five had spontaneous past life memories, and it puzzled their parents because in the West, you know, we just don't believe in reincarnation in the Judeo-Christian culture, unless you dig deeply enough. It's there in Judaism. So that was the beginning of my research, and which led to writing books, because I wanted to write a book for parents. After I discovered Ian Stevenson, which he offers the foundation for the work, he investigated literally thousands of cases in mostly Asian countries or countries in which there was a belief in reincarnation. So the parents were more willing to talk about it, or they could identify it. But there weren't any. He did write a book about Western cases, but it was very, you know, empirical. He was looking for empirical evidence, and he wrote up his cases as case studies.
Yeah. So he never. When I was reading your book, I sort of saw that was, it was mainly academia, wasn't it? He was aiming at academia, not for parents from a different culture who were trying to understand what was happening to their children.
Yeah, and he said nothing about healing, which surprised me. You know, Chase's phobia went away as soon as he talked about his war memory. You know, it was the sounds of the fireworks that triggered his memory, reminiscent of being on a battlefield with guns and cannons and mortars. You know, it's the big booming sounds which triggered him. So it made a lot of sense, you know, obviously. One of the patterns that Ian Stevenson saw was that children can often have phobias relating to the way they died in the past. So, you know, if you die on a battlefield, you might get triggered by loud booming sounds because that might have been the last thing you heard. Or if you drown, you could have a phobia of water, which a lot of children have. So he gave me a platform to stand on with all of his research. You know, he found that children under the age of seven generally have these spontaneous memories. They can have phobias relating to where they died. They can have physical symptoms, somatic memory, which shows up in another life relating to a fatal wound or injury or illness in the past life, which is really incredible. And I can't say enough about Ian Stevenson's research. It was phenomenal. He was totally dedicated for more than 40 years, you know, traipsing around the world, investigating all of these cases. But he said nothing about healing. Even when I met him for the first time after my first book came out, one of the first things I asked him was about healing. And he said, well, you can't prove it. And I said, well, there's evidence for it. You know, and I started talking more about some of the cases that I had found, like my son's, where I instructed parents in how to talk to a child with a past life memory, especially a troubling memory from the past. Because if it is, if most children remember traumatic deaths, those leave a strong imprint on the migrating soul. So the trauma gets stuck. And somehow it carries forward. We don't fully understand in the West the vehicle, but you know, we are energy, and there seems to be some energetic template which is impressed at the time of death or in previous lives with other experiences, both positive and negative, and it carries forward. So it's a very different way of looking at personality too, personality formation.
I mean, in terms of the trauma and the healing potential of recollection of past lives, how does recollecting past lives help in that healing trauma? Does anything need to be done, or is it simply from your experience and what you've heard? Is it just simply for them to remember and for that to be understood?
Not in itself. And it works very much the same way as trauma in this life. So one of the things that I suggest, which is critical, is allow the child to talk about their memories. Don't shut them down. And a lot of parents in the West are totally freaked out by this. They think it's dangerous for a child to remember or to talk about it. But I found the opposite. They sometimes, the soul needs to express this. That's why it's coming up, because the soul wants to heal. Healing is needed. So if you address it as an opportunity and allow the child to talk about it and use open-ended questions, not planting suggestions, but this is where my counseling background came in handy, you know, just reflecting back what they're saying. Oh, you died in a fire. What happened? Or, yeah, I used to have a wife and children. Oh, really? Tell me about them. You know, just allow the child to talk about it. And then, you know, I kind of just stumbled onto this technique, which I think really helps, is because children are close to these memories in consciousness, you know, there's this stream of consciousness that carries over. And the way they talk about these memories when they're 2, 3, and 4 is sometimes in the first person, as if this event is in current time. So they don't necessarily know that they made a transition through death into a new body. So if you can help them clarify that in very simple language, say, you know, if they're talking about it, say, yeah, well, that's something that happened before. And give them assurances if they need to feel safe. You know, I will protect you, or you're safe now. You're now safe in a new body. This can work like magic.
Because
I can help them process it.
Yeah. Because I mean, I suppose you, and I know you get asked this all the time, but you know, so say you are a mom and your child starts talking like that. How do you know that they're not just in a fantasy? Obviously, kids have very imaginal, concrete imaginal worlds. How do you know, actually, this is different? This is a memory of a past life, not just a fantasy or something that they're creating.
And you might not initially know in that moment when a lot of mothers go into shock. You know, when you hear a child, a 2 or 3 year old, talk about how they died. That's usually the tip. That's the direct tip off. That, you know, you're in a past life memory if they're talking about how they died before, but that they may not start the conversation in that way. So if they say something shocking about when I was here before, when I was big, or when I was a girl, a boy saying when I was a girl, or vice versa, or when I was a mommy, listen and don't shut them down. Ask open-ended questions. see if they're troubled by the memory. They may not be, which is fine. And it might explain a lot about your child's personality, knowing where they've been. Mm-hmm. So if they talk about, oh, when I was big before I had a farm, I had horses. Oh, that's nice. You know, you don't have to do anything with that one necessarily until they say, and then we had a fire and we all died. Then you might need to say, reassure them that they're now safe in a new body, for example. Some kids remember positive experiences, which can explain current abilities or talents or wisdom. You know, we're not coming in as blank slates. That's the obvious thing. And there's also a tone of voice that children use when they talk about these memories. They're very matter of fact. Sometimes they sound a little more grown up, and sometimes they will use words outside of their so far learned vocabularies.
Or
talk about things that there's no way in the world they could know about at age 2, 3, or 4. In my second book, In Return from Heaven, which is really about reincarnation in the same family as you discovered, there's a great case of a little boy who remembered dying. It sounded like a World War I battlefield in France. I think he said it was France, and they were walking through the mud. This is a 3-year-old, 3 to 4-year-old. And he was shot in his throat. And in this life, at a very young age, he developed a thyroglossal duct cyst in his throat. And it spontaneously went into remission after he talked about his life as a soldier who died from a gunshot wound to his throat. And he gave his physician father an accurate clinical description of what it was like to die with a gunshot wound to the throat. And there's no way in the world a kid that age could know. I don't even know that. So, you know, they'll talk about things that you know they've never been exposed to, or they'll talk about it in such a matter-of-fact tone that it really grabs a parent's attention. And a lot of times with a fantasy, if you're around young children, when they talk about a fantasy, you know, sometimes it's pretty obvious to tell what's fantasy, you know, kind of implausible scenarios, but it's also the tone of voice. It's sometimes it's more in a kind of lilting, sing-songy voice. But with this, their demeanor is very serious, very matter of fact. And if we challenge them saying, oh, this is something you saw on TV, they will say no. They can make that distinction, and they get a little frustrated with us if we don't understand. They assume we can remember too. So there are ways to tell, and my advice is just listen and see where it goes, and you might be surprised, or it might be a fantasy. It may be something they picked up from a movie, or I don't know, some other means. But usually it's easier to tell with a 2, 3, or 4-year-old that this is something not of present experience.
Yeah. What I was really interested in the examples in your books was, I think all of the parents actually said they sort of felt like something different was happening. You know, they said they got sort of chills or kind of rushing sensations, or the heart started beating. And quite a few of them, it happened when they were driving. I think you give some reasons for that as well. And they actually had to pull over because they could sense actually something different happening here.
Yeah. In fact, it was funny because when I was writing the first book, my husband helped me with both books. I really appreciated that too. I was finding so many cases where the young ones were having these spontaneous memories while they were riding along in their car seats. We started calling the car seat the time machine. Here, you want your kid to time travel. But when you think about it, a lot of parents use a drive in the car seat as a way of putting kids to sleep if they're cranky, because it puts them in the hypnagogic state. You know, they go into a light trance state, as we do when we're driving too. You know, we can just zone out. So in other words, they're going into a hypnotic state on their own. which we do all the time in our waking lives. But with the kids, it's like they're lulled into that state where they're receptive to the unconscious impressions. The impressions have always been there. You know, we come in with these impressions, and certain things in our internal world or external world can trigger the memories. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's a smell, sometimes it's the sight of something, sometimes it's meeting someone we've known in the past that can trigger these memories. And sometimes it's just this internal need to heal that will force a memory to conscious awareness.
I mean, how common is it? Because obviously, you know, you put the ad out in the magazine, Mothering, I think it's called, and you got all these experiences, and you got, you know, you started to take interest. And you know how you see things when you take interest. How common do you think it is for kids to spontaneously remember their past lives?
I think it's probably very common. There are no good statistics as far as I can tell, you know, and there are people who have been studying this. Ian Stevenson's colleagues or proteges, you know, I'm not one, because I went into a different direction with it. I'm not trying to prove every case. And that's what his camp is doing. You know, they're looking at cases that can be verified where the children remember enough specific names, details, that they can establish the former identity and match, you know, what carried over. Is this a real memory? But they go to extremes. And after Stevenson published, you know, hundreds of cases that are amazing. You know, I'm going beyond, let's try to prove this. He's already done it. So I'm saying, wow, look at the healing potential of these memories. The soul wants to heal. We're given this incredible opportunity when our children are young to let them let go of this baggage they brought in through past life trauma. And that's really been my focus. And not enough people are acknowledging that yet, in my opinion. You know, there are a lot of really great past life therapists in the Netherlands who are going in that direction with children, in other parts, probably in the UK too. But there just aren't enough people who take it seriously in the way, you know, the psychological community, the medical community is set up. They're not. There's no code for this in their world. You know, there's no description in the manuals. So it hasn't been widely accepted. But, you know, parents get desperate enough, they'll seek me out or other people doing this research to just get a reality check. But unfortunately, I don't know of anybody else who's written a book or even articles about the healing potential. So that's kind of my, I feel like that's my mission, as long as I can keep doing. You know, and the books are out there and they're still in print. But it's so important because I'm looking at the deeper meaning of these memories. And it's endless. And, you know, I'm just scratching the surface. I mean, I hope other people continue this work and can find more too and write about it.
Because what are the kind of common themes that you think that you've discovered in your research about these memories?
Common themes. Well, there are many universal themes we all share. And I think, you know, in the broader sense, consciousness continues after death, no question. And aspects of personality carry over after death, which is really quite remarkable. And I know, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism have, they're different takes on this. But from just the children's memories, I can see that there is some continuity in consciousness and in personality. And trauma from the past can carry over, as well as wisdom, compassion. So there are these bigger patterns, you know, what are we doing here? What's this all about? And another thing I found is there's no straight line of evolution, in my opinion. I mean, I do believe in, what is it, the vertical path where you can suddenly become enlightened. But as far as reincarnation, it's like, what I think happens in some lives, we progress, you know, become more aware, more conscious, but then we can fall back. Maybe we're in just a totally awful situation where we lose our bearings, we lose faith, whatever that means for people. So it's, you know, we could have a setback, but it's still a learning experience. You know, there's nothing lost unless you get totally locked into a certain pattern. And sometimes these patterns do repeat. And I've seen that with the physical symptoms in my own life. You know, I can, because I've done a lot of past life work, I've seen multiple lifetimes in which I died with trauma to the lungs through different, you know, in gas chamber consumption, hanging. So patterns can get locked into place.
And do you think that recollecting these lives can really help shift that?
Absolutely. And I've had a past life therapy practice with adults. I do not regress children. I counsel parents how to talk to their children, help them with their spontaneous memories. But I experimented early on regressing my own children and some of my friends' kids just to see what would happen. And I don't do that. And I really don't suggest parents do that. You know, don't try to bring up the memories, you know, don't try to put them in, you know, use hypnosis or something, because if you aren't trained, you're not going to know how to help them if they get into trauma. But if the kids are remembering these things spontaneously, parents are in the best position to help them. So when they bring it up, if they know how to talk to a child, they can help their own children. And that's why I wrote the books, for parents, not academics. I don't care what the academics think or the scientists.
Well, yes, and reading, there was one sentence that you said that really struck me, which is, proof is not the point, healing and growth and understanding are the point. And I really got that from you. You're not trying to prove anything. You're just you tell a lot of stories, which are absolutely gripping. You know, there was one that really moved me, actually, which was the one about Blake.
Oh, yeah.
Quite early on, you know, that he'd been hit by a truck and his mother just didn't know what to do, you know, because he said, I love you and I hate you.
He was confused. Yeah, that's a great case. And, you know, I keep referring back to that. And that was one of my early cases. But it was such a perfect case because it was the first time I used these healing techniques, which I was thinking about, you know, a real test case. And it worked. Blake was still two when he, a truck was passing by. I think it was a garbage truck was passing by their house. And he was at the front door watching his brother get on the school bus. And he told his mother he was hit by a truck. And she assumed that he was hit with a toy truck in preschool. But no, he said, big truck, big truck. And this is, you know, the kids are adamant about what they're remembering, you know, so when the adult questions them, you know, no, it was a big truck. And then he told his, and Colleen, the mother, had seen Brian Weiss, is, you know, probably the best known past life therapist in the world. She had seen him on television just a few days before, and he made one remark saying that sometimes children have spontaneous past life memories. And in that moment, she remembered that, and she started questioning him. And he ended up saying that the truck rolled over him. He was under the truck. And that's pretty interesting when a two-year-old can give that perspective. You know, they're in it, they're in the memory, you know, they're seeing it as they had before. So it's first person perspective. And he was under the truck looking up at the wheels and how it went over the left side of his body. He made this hand gesture indicating that. And after he was triggered by the garbage truck, his personality changed. He went from a very, very happy little two-year-old to a very withdrawn two-year-old. And Colleen at that point hadn't put it together that it had anything to do with being killed under a truck. She wanted to forget that because she didn't know what to do with it. She didn't want to address it at all. And they were in London at the time, visiting her husband's family and he was in a stroller. I guess it was a Piccadilly Circus, you know, one of those really busy areas. And he jumped out of the stroller as a truck was coming at them. And fortunately, the father grabbed him by the collar and pulled him back. And it must have been incredibly scary for everyone. And that was the moment where Colleen wondered if it could be a past life memory. And there was some kind of repetition going on about him dying under a truck. And it totally frightened her, as it would any parent. And she contacted me at that point because she saw one of those reader ads I had in one of the early magazines. And I told her, you know, he needs to know that you're a different mother. Mm-hmm. Oh, and one comment Blake had made was when Colleen asked where mommy and daddy were at that time when he was hit by the truck, he said they went bye-bye at the store. Mm-hmm. So apparently he was unsupervised for, it could have been a moment. Mm-hmm. Or we don't know. But when she was telling me all of this, I said, he needs to know he's in another life, another body. He's mm-hmm. safe. Is something that happened before, clarify it for him. So I told her, wait until he's relaxed or brings up the memory himself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to push it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to plant anything. So one night as he was after his bath, when he was nice and relaxed and on his in bed and she was tucking him in, she said something about, do you remember when you were hit by the truck? And he said, yes. And she told him, you know, you're now safe. That was something that happened before. And she named everybody in the current family to ground him in this reality. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hear from her after I gave her all these instructions on what to do and explained the principles. I didn't hear from her for a week. And I thought, oh, that's a shame. You know, I don't know any therapist she can take him to, because he was really depressed. He turned into a depressed little boy and he talked about aches and pains on the left side of his body. And when she tried to comfort him, he would say, I love you, but I hate you. And she didn't know what to do. And she was ready to take him to a therapist when she called me. And I said, look, try this first. It can't hurt. It might help. And hadn't heard from her for a week. And she called and she said, you won't believe what happened. Mm-hmm. She said, immediately his personality reverted back to his happy self. Mm-hmm. And the aches and pains he talked about after he remembered being hit by the truck, the same part of his body, completely cleared up. Mm-hmm. It was like that.
Yeah.
And healing can happen that quickly with kids that age if you address it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of my seminal healing case besides my son. You know, I wanted to try it with some other child who is having memories of a traumatic death. Mm-hmm. And it's worked many, many times. I used to get a lot of emails from parents, not so much. I haven't been that active the last mm-hmm. few years, but it works.
Yeah, I think that's what struck me. It was just so simple, you know, and he'd been really quite traumatized and jumping in front of a truck and very depressed and with these pains. And it was just that acknowledgement and I suppose her just taking him seriously. And I think that surprised me. I mean, there were quite a few, you know, I'm a Buddhist. I said to you in an email that I've instinctively believed in rebirth, I think all my life, but there were a few surprises from your book. You know, just a few things that I thought, oh, I hadn't realized that would be part of it as well. I don't know if there was any surprises for you.
Oh, yeah. Always. Every day. So what surprised you, having studied Buddhism, you know, living that life for so long, what surprised you about past lives or healing or the consciousness?
I think, well, one thing was that the healing of how important it was just to acknowledge it. And yeah. and that may seem to make such a lot of difference. I think the other thing was that it wasn't linear. I tend to be a bit literal about things. So, you know, and but this wasn't linear. It wasn't like, you know, someone just died and was immediately reborn. But there was also a bit of an intermediate state. Yeah. And that they could also had a lot, they seemed to have some of the children recollected having quite a lot of conscious choice about where they were reborn and with whom. And yeah, and this whole theme of being reborn within families, you know, and then of course you do sit there and you think about my family and think, who have I known before?
Right. Well, I think we run into people we've known before. I mean, I have, but also this is what I discovered. I don't know where the.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
The Tibetan. When I was 19 and it changed my life, but it's all here in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Bardo's. Mm. You know, there is that intermediary or the intermediate state Tibetans call the Bardos, and they talk about, you know, focusing on or releasing, focusing, you know, how you're going to set the tone for the next life. And they talk about the moment of death being very significant, you know, where we can carry from that moment, you know, especially the trauma, it has a tight grip.
But what was interesting as well about those children's memories was it seemed to me that the death itself wasn't frightening. And, you know, the actual death itself wasn't frightening. The trauma before death, like drowning or being hit by a truck or something, was traumatic. But in terms of actually dying, they seem to accept that quite matter of fact.
Yeah, they do. But it's so interesting that they do accept that. And sometimes if they feel stuck, you know, they're still a little stuck in the past. You remind them that they of their births, you know, it's almost like, oh, and then what happened after you died? Oh, I came back in I came to mommy's tummy. Now I'm here. I mean, they do remember some of the journey. And sometimes they will talk about being with beings in that state between death and rebirth. Or it's interesting. I think it's kind of culturally dependent, you know, what they see or what, you know, if they're Christian, they might see Jesus or Mary. I remember I went to a seminar in Philadelphia with a Tibetan tulku. And, you know, it was from the Tibetan perspective. He didn't even speak English. He had an interpreter. But he was saying, you know, after death, you see Tibetan deities. Well, not if you're American. You know, you're going to see something else. You know, so it is culturally dependent to some, because it's fabrication of the mind at that point. And what I love about this version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it was the introduction was written by Carl Jung. And he was talking about all the projection in that state, in the Bardos, in the initial Bardos. It's still coming from the mind. You know, so I think there's a lot of that. And, you know, maybe through practice, you can get through that trauma, learn how to do that before you incarnate.
Yeah. Well, it was partly also the reason I was interested in that is because I had a car accident where I thought I was going to die. Like it was very serious. And I had a moment where I thought, well, there's no way you're going to live through this. And what I realized was not, I wasn't frightened of death itself. What I was frightened of was, how it appeared in my mind was breaking my commitments, breaking my ethical. I wanted to check that I hadn't broken any of my ethical precepts. And that was much more important to me, like what I'd done in my life, than the fact that I was going to die or that I thought I was going to die. And that's what made me realize, like, the death itself isn't the thing to be frightened of. It's
exactly.
It's much more than that. I mean, I don't know has hearing all these children's stories kind of influenced the way that you live your life?
I still worry. I don't want to suffer. you know, I worry about things like getting older and what's going to happen to my body, or, you know, thinking of people in Ukraine, what, you know, that suffering, you know, we can't get through life without some suffering in some form, but yeah, I'd like to keep it to a minimum. So, you know, I'm more concerned with, you know, real feelings or pain, emotional, physical, rather than dying. You know, the dying, I know, well, psst, I'm out of here. And, you know, whether we come back to planet Earth or not remains to be seen at this point, I think. Yeah, but it's in people who have near-death experiences, you know, they give very vivid descriptions of what it's like to leave the body. And, you know, there's still consciousness. And you hear some experiences that sound very difficult, kind of dark, but the majority of them seem to be, you know, you're all of a sudden this cosmic conscious being again, you know, going back home, they describe it. But, you know, we're in the, how would you describe it? The super conscious state. So there's nothing wrong with that. You know, and people go into that state through different means and while they're still in the body, having those super conscious moments. But yeah, that's not to be feared. It's more the suffering, I think, on the earth plane. Which this is a tough place to be.
And, you know, in a way, making use of the opportunities you've got while you've got them, because you don't know where you're going to go next, you know.
Can't worry about it.
Ukraine. And so I've got an opportunity here to, you know, make use of conditions for meditation and a good life, in a sense.
But it was interesting that what your concern was when you thought you were going to die. So you had your own life review in that, you know, that moment, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, it really, I did feel actually quite pleased. I did have an overall sense. I mean, you know, this, we're talking about, I don't know, seconds. So it's not like I was thinking in a kind of logical, linear way, but I just had this overall sense. Now I've done what I needed to do. I've done, you know, I've lived a good life.
I think that's the best we can hope for. You know, at the moment of death, to feel, you know, regret. You know, we've done as much as we can or tried as hard as we could. I mean, there's always more work to do, isn't there?
Yeah, but it's interesting, you know, you saying about the kid's life, it's not unnecessary. Like you're saying, it's not a necessary sort of linear progression of, you know, sometimes people say, oh, when, you know, you come on each life to learn the lessons that you need to learn. Well, you might learn them, and hopefully you will, but it's not a given that there's an upward progression.
And I think free will comes into it. But I think also, you know, having said that, I think there is some kind of path. You know, I always tell people that when I work with adult clients, your childhood, the circumstances of your childhood is the karmic setup. And if you have really awful parents or, you know, extreme conditions, that's the setup for what you're to learn about in this life. So it has something to do with where we've been too. I mean, it's all part of something planned, whether we're part of the planning process, not with our earthbound consciousness, but when we leave the body, when we're in a more super conscious state, I think we understand it more, you know, what we want to accomplish in any given life. And this, there is, it's interesting because I worked with an adult client. I know I'm kind of veering off course a little bit about the children's memories, but one of my adult clients had a really horrific childhood with a lot of sexual abuse and emotional abuse and, you know, by family members. It was pretty horrible. And she came to me because she said, I've done years and years of therapy, but I just want to understand why I pick this life. Mm. And when we started the session, immediately she saw herself in these tall black boots, cross belt. Mm. It was something like SS during World War II, man, soldier, going around killing, you know, giving orders to kill, killing women, children. Mm. But this man had a change of heart at some point. Mm. And he said, what I've been doing is wrong, in the persona of this man that she was experiencing. It's wrong. I deserve to be punished for what I've done. Mm. And he purposely put himself in a situation where he was killed by his own people. He just wanted out of that life. He couldn't handle, you can't walk away from the SS. Mm. So his dying thought was, I deserve to be punished for what I did. Mm. And he was shot. And after that persona left the body, that body, when she was in that super conscious state, she understood how she chose her life to balance what had happened. So I think there is a choice. For not, maybe not everyone can make the choice, but it, clearly we are our own judges and juries at some point. Yeah. I think it's just about balance. You know, it's like light and dark, or energetic in some way, emotionally. Mm-hmm. But she, it was as if a great weight had lifted because she finally understood why she needed to experience what she did in childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
So she picked that setup. Mm. You know, yeah. I'm not condoning what happened, you know, but it made a lot of sense that those were his last words, excuse me, and his intention to rectify. Mm. And, you know, she was very, because of her experiences, excuse me, you know, she's a very compassionate, aware person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and did a lot of good work.
Yeah. So actually, because there was a positive intention there before, you know, in the previous life, that was also a positive intention, even though he'd done many bad things, there was a positive intention that carried on further.
Yeah, and I think it's the intention that can modify what happened in a way, or, yeah. But, you know, if you're someone, I'm not going to name names, but, you know, incredibly evil, and there's no awareness, you know, you can come back and experience the same or have it done to you. You know, it's a learning process, because you wonder, why would a little boy be born in Rwanda and have to go out and kill his tribe? You know, just these horrific situations. Why do those things even happen? There has to be something behind it that's, I mean, that's my belief, that is ultimately good. Mm-hmm. You know, that there can be some growth or learning from it.
Because going back to, you know, your experience of collecting these kids' memory, past life experiences,
yeah.
What do you think does motivate them? Because there are quite a few of them, particularly in your second book, where they talk about this being in this intermediate state, and then choosing to go here. And then sometimes, you know, the birth, for whatever reason, doesn't happen. They're not reborn. And then sometimes they stay with the same family. They remember things about that family. And then, you know, try again, as it were, to be reborn in that family. I mean, what do you think kind of propels that choice to be reborn in particular circumstances, very specific where they want to be?
I posed that question to Ian Stevenson as I was writing that second book. I figured he must know. So, I asked him, and he said, isn't love enough reason?
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I did not expect it from him, yeah. That kind of response. But yeah, but also, you know, if you read those cases too, a lot of them had unfinished business with the family. Mm. You know, they died young as children. There were some really poignant cases of that you may have read, you know, just dying in a house fire as a child and coming back to be with that grandmother as much as the mother who was the sister in that lifetime, you know, coming back into that family because that was such a traumatic death for everyone. Mm-hmm. The father and the two-year-old died in the house fire. Mm-hmm. And the two-year-old came back as his sister's child 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And to me that's so hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can happen. I don't know what the mechanism is. You know, is it love is the biggest attractor, or is it, I think it could be vengeance, you know, if the feelings are strong enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So could be a number of things that attract us, pull us back. Mm-hmm. And Stevenson found in some of his research that we're pulled back to the same geographic location.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that's probably changed with our mobility now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all travel now. We, mm-hmm. you know, we don't have to live in the town where we were born or the village.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe it's different now. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just to be with souls we've known before, you know, there are probably any number of reasons to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Because you could, one way it works is you can have that question of like, why was I born into these conditions? But, you know, it's very hard to say why, because of course, obviously you could be in a very difficult position and then blame yourself because you think, well, I must have done something in my previous life, which is, you know, a very literal understanding of karma in the Buddhist tradition of action and consequences. But it doesn't quite seem to work like that, does it? It's like there could be many reasons why you're reborn into a particular life. I suppose the answer is that then you make the best use of what you've got. But I do quite like the idea of love being the biggest draw.
I do too. But then we're all so different.
Mm.
You know, some people can be in a horrible situation and the best of them comes forward, where other people can be in the same situation, the worst comes forward. You know, I think it's so individual.
Mm.
And we create these challenges on some level. Mm. I don't pretend to understand all of it because I learn something new all the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's so much to think about when we realize that this is not the end. The, you know, the end of this life is not the end, that there's a continuation of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are energy, which we are, you know, where are we going to go from here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, have we had other planetary existences or and other dimensions? You know, I think, yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I always say this is just one pit stop in the universe. I don't know, and it's all about feelings and thoughts and, you know, emotions, and like it's very weird when you think about it, how much we're run by our feelings and our thoughts. You know, what this is what creates our reality now.
Mm-hmm.
And our perceptions.
Mm.
Well, you had a great mystic poet, William Blake.
Yes.
Was very much talking about these things quite a while ago.
Mm. Well, you yourself, didn't you? You had an experience when you were younger, before all the experiences of past lives, where, what do you call it, your eternal moment.
Yeah.
Where you saw something yourself. Did you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think people have those epiphanies every now and then. I was a college student sitting on a beach with some friends, and I just, everything expanded.
Hmm.
And I realized I was, you know, eternity in a grain of sand, you know, as William Blake said, something like that. And I knew in that moment that I was more than my body. I also had that experience when I was about four. I remember it, you know, kind of you're out of time, out of body. You're in this other consciousness and you don't forget those moments. And, you know, I've read some of the poets describe those moments too, of cosmic consciousness. And I realized that part of me didn't die, would never die, that it was eternal. And it was, it was so profound. I knew it was true. You know, there was no question that it was true. It was, whoa, it was like the lights came on. And within a couple of days, I was in a bookstore in Cambridge, Mass, not your Cambridge. And I walked in and you know how sometimes a book appears to fall off the shelf right into your hand. You know, it's went for it, opened it up. And it was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it was like, oh yeah, that's kind of what happened to me.
Yeah.
I was, you know, just didn't, you can't stay there. You know, it's kind of a quick view of what's really going, of reality, different reality. Well, I think reality with a capital R. So I think a lot of people have those experiences, you know, through meditation, drugs, spontaneously, in a moment of approaching death, imminent death. You know, you can, oh, that illumination. I think we're all capable of it. It's just this culture is not designed to foster that or nurture that. As you know, that's why you're living in a Buddhist community.
At our best, we nurture that.
Yeah, right. Well, we're all humans.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that's what really struck me about your journey is that, you know, you had that experience as a college student and then you bought the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But in a way, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is so culturally foreign. It didn't quite answer it. And then you look for the poets and T.S. Eliot and William Blake. And then,
exactly.
Then you went on this journey with children's past lives and actually just got, which came from a different angle because it wasn't reading someone else's kind of visions in a way. It was actually just seeing like directly in these children's experience, just building up a body of knowledge from experiences of other people's lives. I found it, and that's what really fascinated me about that. Actually,
that's what I mean by orchestrated. You know, I think the important things that have happened to me, like that, you know, finding my work and having that experience when I was 19, it's, you know, I could have gone either way with it. I could have ignored it or became curious. You know, I was just curious, like, what is this? And I think of my generation too, a lot of us became curious, you know, through psychedelic drugs or meditation or yoga. It was what was happening at that time in the late 60s or mid 60s and beyond. So, you know, it's all, I think what I've experienced is common to many of us. But I was just following my curiosity more than anything. Or as T.S. Eliot said in the Four Quartets, you can have the experience and miss the meaning. So I think if you're really, you know, on a search for meaning, it will come in whatever form or way we understand. And I just feel when both of my kids had past life memories, I haven't talked about my daughters because there's not enough time, but that it just literally fell in my lap. You know, it wasn't like I was searching so much. I was just trying to keep up with my children and my life. But I knew that it was the most interesting thing to me at that moment. It was like, why aren't other people curious about this? I couldn't believe it when I went to write the book that no one had written a book like that. That surprised me. Because but this is so interesting, and this is so real.
Yeah, well, it's very, I can see the books are very helpful. I mean, there's a whole, so you probably won't have time to go into it because I'm aware I don't want to keep you. Well, I do want to keep you here forever, but we can't keep you here forever. But, you know, about abortion and things like that and having a different perspective on things that are very painful in people's lives. But if you look at them from a perspective of having a number of lives, it can bring some healing to that as well. You know, some kids who say, don't worry, this wasn't the time, but I'll be back, sort of thing. Quite a few of those. So
yeah, and I think the real pity is that that awareness has been suppressed through belief systems. You know, I think it's numbed us to the point where even if we have the experience, or, you know, not really talking about my own experience, but generally people don't want to believe it because it conflicts with their religious training or whatever the cultural belief is. No, it's impossible. This can't be happening. And people are going to think I'm crazy. I think I got over that when I was younger, but you know how it is. You know, there are cultural norms that most people adhere to.
And in a way, what you talk about in the book is that sort of concept of beginner's mind, of just hearing experiences. And even if they don't fit into your perceived worldview, just hear it. And, you know, particularly when children are talking, or maybe adults as well, just hear it from their own side, as it were. And that itself is something that we can give each other. It's a gift that we can give each other just to hear.
And I think you pointed it out earlier that just listening to the children, allowing them to express what they're experiencing, is part of the healing. You know, being present, creating that safe space, which is really the key to counseling too. You know, one of the keys, you know, you listen and create that safe space for a young child to know that you're listening and you're acknowledging what their experience is, you know, seems to be.
Yeah.
I think that's true for all of us.
And whatever stage in life and kind of whatever we hear about, you know, what's happening in our own minds.
A lot to think about.
Well, there is a lot to think about. I really enjoyed reading your books. I've really enjoyed meeting you, actually. I was very, very pleased to do this particular interview. And and I just wish you all the best with your work, because it does seem very, very important, you know, and for people. Because as you say, this is really the only book I've come across which is for people trying to make sense of children's past lives. And
it's practical.
It's practical.
Rather than academic, it's practical. Here's what you can do. This is why these memories come up. Don't be afraid. It's natural. It's a natural phenomenon. You know, I keep stressing that. It's common. It's natural.
And as you said, it probably happens more than we think.
Oh, I'm sure. And even reincarnation in the same family. I noticed that after I wrote the first book, I thought, I'm never going to write another book. This is too hard. I just got lucky to get it published. But I started getting these cases, you know, orchestrated. You know, I kept getting the same family cases. And then I got one case of a child who died and came back to his mother 13 years later with a lot of birthmarks related to his disease. He died at 2. I can't remember how many months. And he had some surgical procedures that were done, and he had tumors all over his body. And when he was reborn, he had some of the same physical characteristics related to the illness. In other words, things that couldn't be hereditary. It wouldn't have been passed down on the genes, because they were a result of the disease, of a surgery, that kind of thing. And he started talking about his other life. Even he had died when he was very young, but he had certain memories of the place where they had lived before. And when I got that case, it was, the mother was just so amazingly expressive about her feelings. Mm. You know, I talked to her a lot over about 2-year period, and, you know, just listened to her, because she was, you know, losing a child is one of the worst experiences we can have. And I saw the changes she went through when she was able to acknowledge that her present son, when I came in the scene, he was about 4, was the little boy she had lost 13 years or 17 years before at that point. And how her, everything changed, you know, her grieving process changed, her take on life changed, you know, everything was different. And it really was a miracle. Mm. And we talk about miracles, and that, to me, when you have a child who dies and they return to you as another child, that's a miracle. I just want to add something about, I don't know, maybe I don't understand the concept of time anymore after this pandemic. I think it was about 15 years ago. I could be wrong. TV producer from LA called me. She was a news producer. And she said, I just had to talk to you because we had a horrific accident in LA. You know, the roads around LA are horrible. I'd never drive around there. A woman was in the car with her mother, and her 3 children were in the back of an SUV, and they were rear-ended on a freeway, high speed, and all 3 children died. And yeah, I just, even talking about it makes me ill. You know, just how horrible that experience could be. I think it was within a year or two, she became pregnant with triplets.
Oh. Mm.
And as it turned out, she gave birth to these triplets, and she was on Oprah, and I saw the, you can probably Google it. She was talking about how the triplets, I think they were given the first names of the children who died as their middle names, and she noticed some similarities in personality. Mm-hmm. And the producer called me saying, do you think I should give her your book about same family reincarnation? I said, no. Mm-hmm. Let her come by it. If she's going to be persuaded, let her come by it naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. it could be, it just could strike her as all wrong that someone would suggest reincarnation. Mm-hmm. You know, it was such a sensitive, high profile case. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure. I mean, I think it was 2 girls and a boy who died, and she had 2 girls and a boy in the triplets. So I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a reincarnation case. And, you know, that was a premature death for all of them in that sense.
Yeah, because there are a lot of cases in your books where, you know, a child says, you know, this is who I was, you know, when I was here before. And maybe, and
you don't know what people's religious beliefs are, and I feel like I'm not going to, I would never interfere with that. You know, when something as poignant or as devastating as losing your 3 children. So, you know, maybe someday someone will talk to her about it. I don't know. So I think it happens all the time. That's my sense. Not all the time, but often.
Yeah, well, it certainly does. I mean, yeah, and you're right not to force a kind of connection between the two things, you know, that in a way you have to wait and see what comes out of people's natural experience, you know, rather than saying this is what it is. I think that's right. In the book, you know, all these cases weren't anyone pushing anything.
No.
It was just like at some point the kid would say, you know, and be quite insistent.
Yeah. And I guess my secret hope would be one of those triplets would start talking about it.
Yeah. or maybe, you know, with each other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, remember when we were in the car and we all died? Yeah. I mean, they could be as matter of fact as that, honestly. That's what's so amazing. Sometimes they're extremely matter of fact about having died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no negativity that transferred. You know, it was like, oh, no, you know, I died. But others are still troubled by that, you know, the circumstances of the death.
Great. Well, yeah, thank you very much, you know, for agreeing to talk to us, and there's just so much in there to reflect on, and and just makes you wonder about life and how to live it, and I really to go back to that point about it's not about proof, it's just a lot of experiences that you've seen and heard that have made you question things.
And thank you for doing your homework. I really appreciate that you read the books so we could have a really good conversation.
I really enjoyed them.
Yeah, thank you. I was glad.